Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest episode of the Footnotes podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. And the title for this particular episode of the Footmarks podcast is Strange Occurrences in the BPL. And just to kind of give you a quick overview of what this is about, well, Jared and the rest of the team, we all noticed some really peculiar trends play out in the BPL. But before we get into any of that, because we will be discussing those trends, let's make it clear that no accusations or allegations of match fixing are being made here. And it's all pure observation. Is that right, Chief?
Yeah. I mean, legally, we couldn't make those accusations without hard evidence. We don't have hard evidence. We'll go through what has happened in these games. But essentially, what we are looking at here is telling the story of what happened in the game with the story of what was happening in certain betting markets at the same time. And, you know, that's what we could tell. That's what we will say.
Yep. And another thing that I kind of want to talk about before we get into this discourse is that Jared, for the last 2-3 weeks, has been bothering Varun to get the probability of 7 runs being conceded in one ball in a game of T20 cricket. And I think it came out to around 0.2%, which basically means that it happens once in 500 deliveries. Just to give you guys a bit of a precursor.
I think Varun said that, and Himanesh came up with 0.16 or something, so even fewer again. It doesn't happen a lot, mate, is the best way of looking at it.
Yes, but you know, like, some of these things that have happened, they do kind of raise your eyebrow. What was that Alex Hales game? Was it Rangpur versus Thillet, was it? I can't quite recall.
So the Alex Hales game is the one that's the 10-over game. So that is Rangpur versus Dhaka.
Oh, Dhaka. Right? Correct.
Yeah. And the other one is the Strikers versus... I've now forgotten who they were playing in that one. I'd have to go back and check.
Sillet Strikers versus... Yeah, I can't quite recall myself, but it'll come to me. It'll definitely come to me. Let's just say that 79 runs will be scored at the 10-over mark in the chase. And, you know, when they were... Or 26 runs were required off 12 deliveries... to get to 79. Large sums were being bet on that target to be fulfilled on betting websites. And weirdly enough, the odds, you know, should have changed a bit more. At one point, 18 were required of 8, and then 12 were required of 4. Ultimately, 7 runs were required of a single delivery, which isn't even possible if you bowl a legal delivery, right? The weird part is that the money kept coming in and the betting never stopped, and then 3 ridiculous wides were bowled. Not close calls, like out and out wides. You'd need a separate surface for them. And the target was met. And I'm guessing, or I'm not guessing, I know for a fact that all of those people who were betting made heaps. And that is pretty weird, isn't it?
There was something odd about the betting markets because they wouldn't come down, essentially, is the best way of looking at it. So... when generally what happens is you would have a situation where let's say you needed 18 runs off 10 balls and then the next ball is a dot ball, then the market would come a long way down because it'd be like, well, that's less likely now. It's at least 1.5 runs less likely. And if you have a couple of dots, it happens a couple of times, right? Those things didn't really happen in that game. And as you said, then it went kind of out of control. To the point at which it was like, well, maybe the market's just wrong and all these people were putting money on the wrong thing because quite clearly 7 runs is not going to happen off one ball. And it turned out that the people who had been betting lots of money, Behram, were right, and the normal cricket watchers were wrong.
So basically, just to wrap my head around this, the scenario of the game was changing, obviously, you know, 26 off 12, 18 off 8, 12 off 4, 7 off 1. But the odds or, you know... ratios, they kind of remain steady over there. Was that the odd part?
Yeah, so it usually works pretty scientifically. It's not 100% science because obviously different fans see different things, right? But if you need, let's say you needed 25 runs after 3 overs, right? If the first ball goes for 6, then that run line should go to from 24.5 runs up to, let's say, 26.5 or 27.5, right? Because you've now got 6 runs off one ball.
Yeah.
So the equation changes, right? And that's basically what run lines do kind of all the way through. They're they're just constantly changing all the way through, going up and down, depending on what's happening in the cricket. You know, it's as simple as that. Like, you know, everyone's watching at home. It doesn't matter if it's you with, you might have a huge syndicate where you're betting millions, or it might just be a bunch of fans, but everyone's going, well, that was a dot ball. So it's less likely that it goes higher now. It's more likely that it goes lower. And so if you're watching run lines, I was watching the Australian women's game today on one of their run lines, and it was just really interesting, you know, watching how much, you know, a dot ball brings it down a little bit, a boundary takes it up two or three runs, and that's constantly what happens. And so the issue here was that quite a few people were betting quite a lot of money that this run, that the run line was actually going to be over 78.5, even when the cricket wasn't matching that. Right. And if it happens once, you're just like, well, maybe the market's like, we don't believe it. Right. That can happen. That sort of thing can happen a little bit. Like, I actually think sometimes the market overreacts to an edge for four. They're like, oh, well, now it's more likely. And it's like, well, if someone's just edged it, I'm more likely to think the other way, that actually what might happen here is that the bowls might be on top, not the batters, right? But sometimes the market will see it my way and sometimes it won't. You know, and all these things happen. And what was happening here is you had several, three different occurrences where the market should have gone, ah, we got this wrong. We need to come down. And someone kept artificially inflating it. And then, as you said, it gets down to the last ball. And at that stage, there's a lot of money on the fact that the score is going to be over 78.5, which is seven runs off one ball. And then it happens. So, you know, just to quickly explain brackets. Brackets betting is quite well known if you know about betting in cricket. But essentially, you can bet on the 3rd, 6th, 8th, 10th, 12th, 15th, 18th overs, what the score will be at the end of any of them. The major syndicates bet on the 6th over, the 10th over, and the 15th over. And the reason is that's generally where the most money is, right? But generally, it follows a kind of pattern. Like, you know, so Pal are playing Joburg in a game here. And it was really, really hard for Pal to score. For Joburg to score when they were batting early on. And so my guess is that the run lines would have been quite lower, right? And then, was it the teenager whose bats were Joe Root came out and has just smashed a bunch of fours and sixes, right? My guess is that now everyone's like, oh, well, it isn't hard to bat, so we'll go back up, right? That's how these things work. You start with your best guess and then you work from there. And what happened in this particular case is that that didn't match. And if it doesn't match once, as I said before, you're like, okay. But it didn't match again. It didn't match again. And it didn't match again. On top of that, you know, I don't have the full data on the sixth over. But the sixth over bracket also in that game got scored off at quite a high rate as well. So suddenly you're thinking to yourself, well, why is this happening? Why are so many people putting so much money, right? These weren't little individual bets. They were big chunks of bets on something that is statistically quite unlikely. And then to go back to the brackets, just so we can explain it one final time for everyone. Every bet you make on the bracket is 50-50, right? So, so Pal are 29 without loss after 2.3 overs. If I say they're going to score 68 runs at the end of six overs, 68 or higher, I should say, so 67.5 runs and above, I would put my £1 on and I can win £1 back plus my original pound. And it's the same with you if you go under, right? I don't do a lot of bracket betting unless I see something where I'm like, oh, I think the market's got this wrong or the team's about to go nuts here, right? Because you can't trade out of it like you can with other bets. Like, if you get on the wrong side of it, so you're just like, oh, there's no way they're going to score quickly here. And then this teenager comes out and hits four boundaries in a row. And you're just like, oh, great. Right? So you remember, I bet heaps of brackets on the Pakistan-England women's games. Because I would bet on them being over the bracket in the first six overs because they started really well. And then I'd be under the brackets every other time because I figured at the start of each bracket, we knew that they struggled once the fielders went out, right? But I have to be pretty sure of that bet because it's only a 50-50 bet and I can't trade out of it the way I can with a match. If I put a bad bet on Joburg here, I can then just, I can bet on the other side of Pal. Whereas if you do that on the run lines, what ends up happening is, let's say you bet on the run line being 60 at the end of the six overs, right? And they score 20 runs off the first over, that run line might never get below 60 again. Mm. Yeah. So you're just gone. So you end up going, if I go under, then I'll be like, sorry, if I go over, now I'm at a point where I might be over 72 and I might be under 60. So there's a big 12-run middle where I might get even, I might lose even more runs. So it's a kind of betting that you have to be quite sure about. Hmm. Things change really, really quickly. You can have like a part-timer come on when you don't expect. You're expecting Jasper Bumrah to come on for the fourth over for Mumbai and Sky brings himself on and you're just like, oh, okay, I'm screwed, right? Like yeah, so those things happen all the time.
Just to add a bit more context to what Jared is saying here, I have dabbled a bit in bracket betting back in the day when I was living in Canada. And just to kind of explain this to you from a use case perspective is that let's suppose at the start of the innings, I've gone the team or X team will score 60 runs or 59.5 or more runs in six overs. It is very, you know, volatile in the sense that after every single delivery, the run line keeps changing. So by the midpoint of the power play, that number could look something completely different. It could be 48 or it could be 72. So that's how much this fluctuates, which makes this even more odd, really.
Exactly. And if you compare it to like the game one, you can have a situation. There's a game I was watching the other day. I can't remember who's playing. Hmm. Where the match odds didn't change for like three or four overs. Like they went slightly up and slightly down. Mm. That can't happen with the brackets because if it's a four, then obviously it has to shift quite a bit. If it's a dot ball or a wicket, it has to shift quite a bit. So you have this bit where it's constantly shifting. And as you said, it's kind of, I find it a very nerve-wracking way of betting. If I know there's a, I don't know, a perfect one would have been today in that game I'm talking about with the Paul Johannesburg, where I was like, I was positive that Johannesburg were going to score a bunch of runs at the death based on all the information I had on this pitch and because Johnny Bairstow was out there. And of course, then I didn't put my bet on because I was editing my book. And then I look up and suddenly he's hit three or four sixes off my Parker. Bairstow. And it's like, but the opposite could have happened. The first time he tries to hit a six, he goes out. So it's much more volatile and harder to catch up with. So it's a really interesting form of betting.
So you mentioned betting syndicates and how they use a lot of math, like quantitative math, even matchups, pitch conditions, weather conditions, ground dimensions, you name it. All of these things are in their algorithms when they or before they go ahead and make those bets. But there is a bit of guesswork involved in this as well. What percentage of it would you call all of this to be guesswork? Because, of course, there's a science behind it, but at the start of everything, I mean, there's not a lot of science to go by because you haven't seen a delivery being bowled.
Yeah, so the SA20, I've been betting on it and doing really, really well because a lot of the games have followed pitch patterns, right? Yeah. And if it's following pitch patterns, there's a lot of science in that. I can tell you, Bayram, what this wicket is most likely. As I just said, I thought there would be runs at the end of this game. At the end of that innings, and there were, right? You can make money time and time again by making simple bets like that, right?
And I mean, there are other things as well, because back in the day when I was kind of, you know, dabbling around with cricket betting, I remember in Test cricket, Pakistan were playing in the UAE. It was that year when Australia and New Zealand toured the UAE. Yeah. It's the Phil Hughes year. And I made bank by consistently betting under four runs on Rahat Ali overs, because I could see that the batters aren't really taking any chances versus him. So there's certain things you can pick up on, right?
And that is why Nasser Hussain decided to bowl first at the Gabba. And this all, of course, reminds me of Hit Wicket, which is a mobile cricket strategy game that is all about making those tough decisions. Who do you want to send in as an opener when the asking rate is climbing? Do you go for the big hitter or the steady accumulator? Me, I like to throw in someone a little bit unorthodox, a bit of a wild card like the general. That keeps the opposition guessing. And what about the bowling attack? Do you unleash your express pace early or hold back for the death overs? I'm always tempted to bring on a mystery spinner in the middle overs and just try and break a partnership. Hit Wicket puts you in the captain's chair. You draft the squad and select the batting order and even decide when to use those game-changing abilities. Do you burn your two times ability to chase down a big total or save it for a critical moment later on? It's strategic, it's addictive, and it's more nerve-wracking than facing a Shoaib Akhtar bouncer. Give it a go. Download Hit Wicket and see if you've got the tactical nous to win. So that's another perfect example of a way that you would do stuff like that. And you can be right. Like, so I quite often will bet, I will guess when Sophie Eccleston or Rashid Khan or Jasper Bumrah will bowl, right? And yeah. I will put my bet on at that stage because at that stage, I'm pretty sure that the next ball is going to be bowled by them because that makes the most sense from a cricket perspective. And if it does happen, you know, Sophie Eccleston took 2 wickets in the game today, right? So I cashed in. Right, just by guessing which over she was going to bowl. So you've got stuff like that. Doesn't mean that Bumrah can't get edged for 4 or that Rashid Khan doesn't get any wickets or Eccleston bowls a bunch of wides. All those things are still possible. Rob Barron, our friend Rob Barron, he quite often bets based on intent in T20 games. So if he thinks the batters are just knocking around, right? Like, and he'll look at a situation and look at the players and be like, they're going to knock it around for at least 2 more overs. So I'm going to go under either the individual over or the bracket that they are in. Or the opposite. Oh, they haven't hit a boundary yet, but look how hard they're swinging. It's wicket or a boundary. I'm going to bet on the next over being, you know, the next over's due 7.5 runs and it's going to be above. So there's a science and an art to what you are doing. If it was purely science, then the syndicates would only be winning, right? As I was just saying with this game that we have in front of us, the Paul Johannesburg one, like if you would have assumed that it would have been a little bit tougher for Paul to score off the spinners early on. And so it would have made sense if you would have been like, oh, they might start slow. Instead, they've started the exact opposite, right? And now it's getting tougher as the pitch is getting older. So you could be right and wrong all the time with these sorts of things. And, you know,
You require 7 runs off a single delivery, I'm guessing that the odds should be very lopsided, right? Because that is a very rare, rare probability to occur. And yes. I mean,
so by the time we got to 7 runs off one delivery, the punters at home would have brought that market down. Right?
Yeah.
And this is my guess, even the people who are sure that there's going to be 7 runs off that, they're sure there was going to be 78.5 runs, even they are not going to bet again at that point because they're thinking, well, this is very unlikely. So
you're looking for the cash out button. That's what you're doing. If you can get something back, you get it back.
Exactly. And you can't cash out on those, well, I should say, I know you can't on the major betting side, betting trading sites. You can't cash out. And you wouldn't be able to cash out anyway because that would have been over 100-1, right? So by that stage, you couldn't have even cashed out. You would have just, you know, if you get to a game where the opposition needs 7 runs off one ball to win, it comes up, you usually comes up as 500-1 or 1,000-1, right? Automatically. So you couldn't even do that. You have just lost your bet at that stage. So as far as we're aware, and we can go through the specifics later, but as far as we're aware, the last big bets came in when there was 12 runs needed off 4 balls to go past 78.5, which again is not a 50-50 chance.
Absolutely right? Not.
Especially not in the 9th or 10th over. Like no one's expecting you to score at 3 runs a ball at that stage, right? It's a very, very odd thing.
You looked at the average or mean strike rate in the 10th over as well, and it was quite low, right?
Yeah. I didn't realize actually how low the 10th over was as a general rule. It was like the 4th slowest over in T20 cricket. And I think that's probably come in because so many leagues now have timeouts automatically at the 10 overs. Yeah. Like there's quite a few teams that do that. So that might be why it slowed down. But either way, it's a slow over and has always been a slow over. So it's you're not expecting 3 runs a ball, even at the death. Maybe if you've got like Andre Russell going nuts or someone else, but it's very rare you would ever think that 3 runs a ball are a 50-50 chance, and people were betting as if it was.
Yeah, that was basically the game in which you kind of, you know, picked up an oddity within the run line, and it had you very, very intrigued and fascinated.
This is the big thing is, and we talk about it in the main piece, is sometimes what happens in some of these leagues is people assume fixing is happening because the odds are wrong, right?
Yeah.
And people then start betting, believing that the fix is in, and that's not what's happened at all. It's just that one person with lots of money. In fact, I was told a story recently about this one person who bet so much money on a game that everyone in cricket believes this game is fixed, right? And it now turns out that it probably wasn't fixed. It was one guy who put so much money in the game, it looked like it was fixed. Yeah. And so you have these sorts of situations happening again and again, right? And you don't really know what is happening. The difference here is we were given information that they were going to score over 66.5. Is that what it was? It was about that anyway, wasn't it?
It was 65.5, I think. So 66 runs needed to be scored. And they got there with the ball to spare, I think.
Yeah. And so in our heads, and what I was doing on that chat and what you were doing as well, is we were trying to work out how you would get to that total. Hmm. Right? And what was incredible to us is that is the sort of thing that we then saw. Right. Yeah. And as you said, it ends up with a ball to spare. Hmm. And so for me, I think that's the first time in my career I've ever had, like, I've been told, oh, so-and-so is fixing or this is fixing, whatever. And then when you watch it, it doesn't quite match up. Right. Hmm. No one told me this game was fixed. It's really important to say this, both of these games, no one told me they were fixed. What I was told specifically is that a lot of money has come in for over 65.5 runs. And we were like, well, mathematically, that doesn't make any sense because they need two runs a ball. And as you said, I think Cornwall and Munsey were out, who are the two guys most likely to score two runs a ball as well in the entire team, who were out. Then, as we're watching, Aaron Jones is out. And Aaron Jones just hit a couple of sixes. But again, the run line doesn't change. It stays at the same. And, you know, and I'm watching it. And even as it's getting less and less likely that they're going to get to this amount, it happens. Then you see, you know, things happening that it is very hard to explain.
Yeah.
That sixth over, if I had not had any information or not, it is still one of the worst overs I've ever seen bowled in T20 cricket. Like, it really was, the ball was going everywhere. And even, I think it went for 18 or 19, that over.
Something like that, yep.
It could have gone for more because some of those balls were just absolutely horrendous and they weren't punished. So it was incredible. And I don't know how you felt, but as someone who was watching it live, it was just like, what are we actually watching here?
I know you have reached out to the ICC and the BCB and Betfair and everything. So what sort of response did you get from there?
Betfair took about a day and a half to get back to me and then gave me an email of someone. I've emailed him. I've not got a response. BCP, I could only find one email on their website. And to be honest, I didn't spend hours checking it, but I emailed it and it bounced back. What the ICC said was what I knew they would say, if we're being honest, mate, which is I knew they would say, we don't run this league. I think a lot of people have been tagging the ICC in our stuff over and over again. The ICC can't actually force themselves in here because the boards put something in that they run their local leagues. So where this is an issue, and I'm not saying a BPL, but for all of cricket, where this is a big issue is if your players go to a league where they are corrupted and then they come back and let's say you're the ICC, so you don't even pay these players. They come back and they play in an IPL. Once a player is corrupted once, they can be corrupted multiple times because you have evidence on them, right? If you're the fixers at that stage, you have stuff on them, right? So you get to a point where these it can't really be a situation where the ICC is not involved in this anymore, but that's not how the boards want to play it.
So based on what you've just told me, the big question that comes to my brain is who benefits from investigating a franchise T20 league? And the immediate answer that comes to my brain is, well, no one.
So this is my big issue. So I was going to write a book on corruption in sport a couple of years ago, and I never quite got around to it. It might still be something that I want to write about. But basically, what I want the book to be about is that I think it was in the 1960s, right? We got together as a sporting world and we decided that drugs in sport were bad. And we were going to have up with a global organization called WADA, whose job it was going to be to make sure that athletes didn't use drugs anymore. And I still think it's one of the most incredible things that ever happened in sport because it happens across sports. So many, I know it took cricket a long time and a couple of other sports, I think NFL was another one, but most sports over time go, we want to be involved in this. We don't want to be involved in drugs. And what it means is that, I don't know, sprinting and cycling and, you know, whatever other sports, you know, come involved, don't have to test their players. It's done independently. And so they don't have to go and do it. That is what we need for corruption. Because think about it this way, and I'll tell you the story. I think this was a story that Dick Pound told, and he was, I don't know if he was the first guy in WADA, but he was one of the most important people at WADA for a long time. He spoke to the people in the PGA, right, in America, and he said, golf is the sport where you actually say, that person over there is cheating, and I'm going to mark them down, and you can mark yourself down and all this sort of stuff. And he said to the golf people, wouldn't it be incredible if you were the first sport who actually had different athletes saying, this person is doping, and this person is doping, and here's why I know they're doping, and everything else. And the golf guy said, yeah, but how does that help us, right? Because then we have a sport where we suddenly, no one thinks of golf as a doping sport, and now everyone thinks of it as a doping sport. They're going to make less money. And it's the same same conversation I've had for years with corruption within cricket and other sports as well, but cricket specifically, because that's my main thing of, how does it help these people to come out and say that there is corruption, right? Yeah. It doesn't help. It doesn't help at all for you to come out and say that this is corrupt or that this player is on drugs or anything else. So the only way to fix this is for it to be independent, right? Which is kind of what the ICC is. But even so, the ICC has a vested interest. They don't want to come out every week saying that someone is fixing or on drugs either, right? But just they are that, slightly more independent.
Just on that, we do have the Anti-Corruption and Security Unit, right? And retired or recently retired ACSU chief Alex Marshall, he warned us about some dodgy business happening in some of these lesser T20 franchise tournaments, right? Before he kind of exited. And I mean, you just have to watch the cricket at times to kind of get a sense of what he's talking about, because you get these insanely wide wides. And you
I watched a T10 league recently where a very good bowler was bowling with all the field up on the leg side and all the field back on the offside. And he bowled three balls down the leg side. And then they moved the field and they swapped it. So they put everyone out on the leg side and he bowled his next ball wide outside off stump. And again, I have no data to say this person was fixing and I have no evidence to say. But you are watching it going, how can a player who's played test cricket get his wits wrong, or his lines wrong, so tragically over a period of time? And I think what Alex Marshall was really talking about as much as anything, and the main conversation I had was the T10 leagues.
Yes.
And some of the really small 2020 leagues as well. There is a lot of concerns when you speak to people about them. There's no doubt about that.
Another thing that I've picked up on, I think I actually first noticed this when I watched that video that you did with Bumble, is that quite frequently in T20 cricket, we see that short fine leg is up and bowlers keep feeding the batter's hip. I have never played professional cricket, right? I've played a bit of hardball, and like street cricket with a tennis ball was my jam. I wouldn't even do that, you know?
It's, yeah. I mean, you know, and that's one of the other things, is there are lots of ways to do it quite subtly and to get thing and to get away with it. Sometimes, and I'm not making this up, some players just aren't trying in some of these leagues. Do you know what I mean? Like that player I'm talking about before could easily have been not trying. And what you're talking about as well is sometimes the ball just doesn't come out right. And you're trying to bowl. The team says, keep it on the stumps. And you're like, well, short fine legs up. And they're like, yeah. But just keep it on off stump and you'll be fine. And they just slip it down a couple. Those are genuine questions, of which most times when someone will contact me and say, oh, I was watching this game and it's fixed, and I go back and I look at what they're talking about, and I'm like, that looks like normal cricket. And what you're talking about there looks like normal cricket. The ones where it doesn't look like normal cricket is where two balls in a row go down to pass short fine leg. Then they put fine leg back and the next ball is wide outside off stump with short third up. And you're sitting there going, wait a minute. So I usually think it's a combination of the patterns. We have to allow for the fact that cricketers are going to make mistakes. Like in the game that we were just talking about a moment ago, I can't actually remember which one, it's the first one we talked about before, the one with the 10 over bracket.
Rangpur versus Dhaka.
Yeah. Jason Roy drops a catch, right? In the middle of me saying all these things, I'm not accusing him or anyone else of this.
Yeah.
It was a really, really high catch. And it looks to me like he overruns it a little bit, right? Now, that's why I don't want every mistake on a cricket field. So I've been getting messages from people the last couple of days going, there were three wides bowled in another game. And I looked it up. The three wides were bowled in the 19th over. I expect three wides in a row in the 19th over. You've got someone smashing the ball. You're trying to bowl wide outside off stump. No issue with three wides in a row. What we're looking at is how often do three wides in a row happen in the 10th over? Well, that doesn't happen very often because at that stage, you're not trying to bowl wide Yorkers, right? Or anything else. And when you've got a new batter on strike as well, why do you need to bowl wide to them in the 10th over? Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
The game in itself was kind of done and dusted. So where's the pressure coming from?
Yes, exactly. And that goes back to what Rob Barron was saying, I was saying about Rob Barron before, where he's looking for an intent. If he was looking to bet on that over, he'd be betting on them knocking it around for a couple of balls, right? Exactly. Make sure both the batters are in. And then once they're in, they clearly wanted to finish that game earlier. Like, no one would doubt that because they're only chasing, 112 or 120 or whatever it was. But at that stage, when a new batter is on strike, there shouldn't be that kind of pressure because you haven't been hit, right? The ball hasn't gone anywhere.
Yeah. So all of this is pure inquisition. We're kind of just speaking out our minds just to kind of reiterate over there. And since you've mentioned like Rob Barron three times already, you also in your piece spoke of how Rob Barron called the BPL the most erratic market of any major T20 competition. And you also mentioned that professional punters, you know, they refrain from betting on the BPL due to this very, very apparent volatility. And all of these patterns are far too random in the BPL, and not just the BPL, also in some of those T10 leagues, right? So, I mean, someone needs to address this or look deeper.
So what the professional punters are saying, and what Rob Barron's sort of saying as well, is, and it goes back to the original conversation we had. It's very, when you're betting, especially when you're betting big, big money, right? So some of these BPL games, I've seen between $6 and $10 million bet on them, right? In the UK. Usually, if that's the case, in the Asian markets, there's another $6 to $100 million bet, right? That's the difference. The illegal markets are so much bigger, but they follow each other. If you're betting that kind of money, you want it to follow a pattern. Even if that pattern sometimes is wrong for you. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would love it if the market thought like me and they made this a favorite, right? Like because that's where I have my money at the moment. But you want it to follow the pattern because you're kind of betting on the patterns, right?
Yep.
And you said before, you know, they use quants, right? Like, a lot of these big syndicates use quants. Even someone like me, I use a lot of data when I'm doing stuff, and I want it to follow a pattern. Almost every league in the world does. You're always going to have anomalies, right? There's going to be someone who comes on to bowl and the market's just going to be like, nah, this guy's going to go, right? There's always little things like that happens, right? You know, women's cricket can be quite volatile because a lot of the people who bet on women's cricket don't know anything about women's cricket. They're just doing it because it's another game that's come up and they've been betting on men's cricket. And you'll see the market just wildly going around, right? The problem with the BPL is that it always happens. To the point at which big gamblers are saying, we can't bet on this because it is not following genuine cricket patterns. And I think what Rob talks about in the piece or in the quote that he gave me is that there are games where the team has been like none for 15 after the first over, right? So that the batters are well on top. Every cricket fan in the world knows that means the batters are well on top. And yet the market has said bowlers are more likely to win this game now, right? You can understand, you don't need to be an expert in betting, or even cricket to understand that doesn't make sense. If something good has happened for the batting and quite substantially good, like a first over in cricket goes at about 6.5 runs an over, right? In general. So if you're going at 15, you're much more likely to win the game now than you were before that over, and yet the market is telling you that the bowlers are there. And that goes back to the other thing that we talked about briefly before, is this isn't all fixing. This market is really, really erratic. And I would say that perhaps one of the reasons it's a bit more erratic, associate cricket and women's cricket, as I mentioned before, can be sometimes quite erratic as well. In those two, though, it's people betting on them that don't know anything about the game. And so they'll put a big bet on and then instantly realize they're wrong and try and fix it and everything else. Whereas in the Bangladesh Premier League, we're talking about millions and millions of dollars. It's not a small betting pool where you can warp it easily. It's a massive betting pool, as I said. 4 million, 6 million, 10 million on the legal Betfair type markets. And yet it doesn't follow the patterns that you want it to follow, right? And And this is one reason why, well, there's many reasons why I'm big on legalized gambling. But one of the main reasons I'm big on legalized gambling is because when there is legalized gambling, you can get information from the betting markets about these kinds of things. If you make it all illegal, you cannot get this information, and it's just mafia at that point.
Because, and to my understanding, in order to counter this potential malpractice, right, when something seems fishy, you do require hard evidence. And I mean, hard evidence isn't easy to get your hands on, like a sting operation, tapped messages or phone calls. That's not, you know, stuff which is readily available or anything. You can't get your hands on that. So I agree. If you legalize betting, you can potentially fix that, right? But I mean,
and just on the hard evidence, if you go through the history of cricket, how many betting scandals match fixing scandals, I should say, have come from journalism?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And I mean, Cronier's phone was tapped, right? Some dude heard that phone call. He didn't even know it was Cronier. His kid told him that this is Hansi Cronier's voice. And then, of course, Yasir Ahmed was at the center of the sting operation in which Amir Asif and Butt got caught. I can't even remember the name of that publication. Was it News of the World?
Yeah, something it was, like wasn't that. It? One of the last things News of the World did before they got, before they went. But, you know, a lot of the match fixing we've had has come from journalism, right? Hmm. And I want to be really fair to the ACSU people, because I've met a lot of them. They do a lot of work, really hardworking people. It is so hard to be able to really work out if someone is fixing. Some players, the story I heard of Salman Butt was that he had 7 mobile phones.
Hmm. And tons of watches.
Right? But he had 7 mobile phones because he was sending messages on all different devices at all different times to all different kinds of people and receiving them from all different kinds of people. How do you... The ICC can't subpoena phones, right? Yeah. They can ask for one phone as a player goes into the ground, right? So there are all these different things that it is really hard. And I really feel for the anti-corruption units in general. As I said before, I don't think it's the right system. I think it should be done in a different way and everything else. But, you know, a lot of the anti-corruption stuff, they're also trying to stop people from betting in the grounds and doing what's called court-siding, right? Also, there's all these different things. They're trying to stop fixers from coming in and watching games. Like, there's so much that is going on. And you're talking about international relations when it comes to trying to work these things out. You've got... Yeah. A player who maybe let's go back to Salman Butt. I could be wrong with this, but I know I'm right with some of the players. Salman Butt is from Pakistan, but has houses in Dubai where he spends the majority of his time. He's then in the West Indies for the World Cup, and they're going from island to island to island as well. Think about all the jurisdictions I just mentioned.
Yeah.
Right? It's crazy. Cricket media used to be pretty simple. Find your favourite newspaper, head to Cricket Info, and maybe a blog you'd like. Now just finding the best stories and writing is a huge challenge. You already have a job. You just want to read about cricket. Well, that is what the best of cricket is currently doing. They go out daily to find the newest cricket coverage and the best stories from any publication in the world. And when they can't discover what they want, they also hire some of the best writers to produce their own great stories. You can get the best of cricket via their website or on WhatsApp. They find cricket's best stories and give them to you every day.
It is pretty crazy. And I mean, the one thing that kind of sticks out like a sore thumb for me over here is that there is no incentivization to make the leagues clean, and you don't have an independent body to kind of ensure that the sport is clean. And I can't help but feel that there's a big difference between 18.3, delivery 18.3 in a test match is going to be a no ball, versus bracket betting, which kind of tells you that more people are in on this, if it's true.
So the 18.3, you're talking about Mohammed Amir's...
I mean, it's not 18.3 specifically, but you get the drift, right?
Yeah, but you're talking about that. So that wasn't... So that was proof, wasn't it? It's not. They weren't betting on that. They were asking for proof that these people could manipulate the cricket when needed for them.
Yep.
What we're talking about here is the market assuming that a very unrealistic number was about to happen. Mm. Despite all evidence to the contrary, and people were actually making money from them. It's all the same thing, but they come from two different things, two different worlds, if you will. The issue is, how do we find out what is real and what is not real? And as you said, if there's no one who can really search this or, you know, is involved in this, you know, I'll happily talk to anyone from the BCB about this kind of issue and other issues like it. This isn't the only issue that we have with corruption within cricket as well. You know, it was incredible that I think, 24 hours before my piece went live, there was an article saying that one team had not paid their players in the BPL.
The local players, I believe, weren't paid in that team.
So again, like, my God. So there are many issues that lead to these sorts of conversations. But the bigger issue is, at the moment, once we have been able to show a betting anomaly and repeated betting anomalies in these cases, both of these cases, it wasn't one bet. It's that the betting, that especially with the one in the sixth over, that run line, you and I were watching it, that run line just wasn't coming down. Right? It's
true.
It was like, the audience was like, no. This is definitely going to happen. The other one at least did come down a little bit, but was still way artificially way too high for way too many different periods. But the question is, when are we going to get to the point where we start to, how do we look into this? How do we match it up? Shouldn't players be called in to have to justify this, right? Now, there's two situations that I can tell you about that I know about. One was in the NBA, where there were betting anomalies with one player, and the NBA just brought the player in, right? And he ended up saying, yes, it was me, and I think he's now in jail, right, that player. The other one is the European Cricket League, who do a very similar thing, and they look at data, and they go back and they say to this player, well, you're bowling an abnormal amount of wides. You're involved with three different, either, I think some of it is betting, some of it is fantasy spikes. You can ask the players you don't have to be accusing them of fixing, but you can go to the player and go, we have noticed this anomaly. Right? And it's anomaly one. We're not worried about it. If we see anomaly two and anomaly three, you're going to have to come in and justify what is happening to us. And then we're going to make some decisions based on that. And at the moment, cricket seems afraid to make that call. Right? I think that's where we have to get to. Am I wrong?
Legalizing cricket betting would be the only way out of this, no? Because then betting companies can work directly with the ACSU.
But we already have, the betting companies are already working with the ACSU. So when something like this happens, I send it to the ICC immediately. I'd be shocked if other people didn't do the same thing, right? So that, you're right. The biggest problem is prohibition doesn't work and people are going to gamble anyway. Right.
Yep.
And so if you make gambling legal, it takes away the mafia element to how it's currently run. It'll be taxed to death. So you'll be ruined in a different way, everyone. But, it'd be like, you know, trying to buy a pack of cigarettes and having to pay four times as much as you should because of the taxes on them. But there is an element of that could happen. But that information's already coming. So what the ICC, I think they have two integrity partners. They certainly have one major one, which I've now forgotten the name of. They have that information that they can go through. It's not always the situation that it's very hard to get it on a ball by ball. That was for this story. I found it so hard to actually match up the exact ball with the betting. Right. And so I had to go with eyewitnesses and in some cases I had people taking screenshots for me. So I was okay to be able to get it. But the point being is it's very hard to do that, but the integrity partners give that information to the ICC. But unless I'm wrong, Bayram, I don't see a situation where the players are then forced to come in and have a meeting about the fact you played in this league, and in this league we have three situations where there was anomalies in the betting industry based on your bowling or your batting or whatever it may be. Surely that is the adult and grown-up way to handle this sort of situation. It shouldn't be up to me as a judge. I don't have as much information as the ICC have on these cases, right? I just did the work, right? But I don't have the information. It was really hard. Like Betfair didn't even get back to me. They didn't want me writing about this, right? And I can understand why they didn't as well. But when it comes down to it, that is what we have to do. And that's why I think what the NBA did, what the European Cricket League does makes a lot more sense. There is an anomaly here. We would like to speak to you about this anomaly. Is there anything you want to tell us at this time? Can you talk us through this over and what your plan was? Can you talk us through this shot or this run out or whatever it may be? And there are quite often, Bayram, they might be able to go, I tell you why I did that. He told me, the guy at the other end told me he didn't want to play face left arm finger spin. And so, yeah, you're right. It was a stupid run and I was never going to make it. But I had in my head that I had to get back on strike because he wouldn't have been up. Great. Next time there's another anomaly, right? And there's another one. Now you've got three anomalies stacked up. Now explain the next two, right?
Yeah, I mean, that does make sense.
We can have these conversations.
But in a perfect world solution where you have an independent body running specifically to kind of catch these outliers and anomalies and then further investigating by calling in the players and not directly accusing them, even in that perfect world situation, I mean, can it even happen without an independent body? Because right now, cricket is too disparate. It's all over the place, right? With the different boards and the different leagues and the franchise owners and then the ICC being this event management company, which doesn't even take ownership of all of these separate leagues. It's, I mean, it's too haphazard.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting one. I find it interesting that, as I said, I've reported this to the ICC. I've reported both of these incidents to the ICC now. And I know quite a few other people did at the time and since. And obviously what I said before about the ICC is they said, we're not in charge of this competition. I don't understand how that stops them from seeing corruption in a sanctioned league and taking action. I understand how it stops them having officers on the ground. I understand how it stops them from, you know, policing the PMOA area and all those sorts of things. Then I'm not expecting the ICC to be in hotel 4 years, which is what they do, by the way, looking to see if there's any fixes coming in, right? Because they're not being paid for that, and that is not their job. What I don't understand is why they are not looking at these anomalies and trying to do this. And these anomalies, it's not the first time I've been told of this. It was just the first time I was able to completely back it up with, thanks to the BPL for having all the video on their on their site. Thanks to all the different sources who had, like, had multiple people had seen the two different incidents that I was looking at. So it wasn't like it was one off. Like Revy Leia was the one who put it up on Twitter, but I could talk to other people who were like, yep, that happened. I saw that too. And yes, he's right. This is the period which I thought that was happening. But the point is, why are we saying, I know for the last 8 years that they've had integrity data from gambling sites available to them. Why is that not being used in discussion with the players so that we can have a nice, healthy dialogue about what is and what isn't happening on our cricket fields? That would be my issue, Bayram, at the moment. And I don't have a good answer for that. You're right that the ICC is not perfectly set up for this. But if they could see, their data partners would be able to show them the same information that I had access to and more. And this has happened in tournaments that they do look after, right? They are waiting for someone to be caught, you know, in a lobby with someone, or someone to be passed a mobile phone or a sting operation, or another player to say, this guy's been having dinner with this guy and he shouldn't be having it, all that sort of stuff. Why are we not using the actual information of the games with all the data that we have, and then all the data from the betting markets to be able to take these players and go, no one is accusing you of fixing, but we need you to explain this thing. The same that would happen if you do something at work, right? And I don't like it. I say, can you explain to me what you've done here? And I'll be like, okay, I understand that now. Maybe this is what we can do in the future or whatever else. It's a perfectly normal thing to have happen. Corruption doesn't go away because you don't ask the questions. That's the most important thing, right? It does not go away because you go, oh, there was an anomaly here, but it would be a bit awkward if we had a conversation with this player. No.
Yeah.
You have to do
it. I mean, to sum this up, I suppose the million-dollar question over here is that why are we being reactive and not proactive about this? That's basically, you know, a quick summary of everything. But I suppose we've given all of our viewers and listeners lots of food for thought. And that's what we'll kind of end this at. So thank you for staying here for whatever 50 odd minutes of this podcast. And just a quick reminder to all of you, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage, and that can prove to be a one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written pieces, videos, or podcasts. And yeah, we'll see you soon enough on another show, potentially another Footmarks or a Quick Picks or a live show. We don't know as of yet, but we also hope that you enjoyed this one and have a good week. That's it from us, guys. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.